Good afternoon. The time is 2 o'clock. Welcome to Vox Pop for this Thursday, April 4th. I'm Ray Graff. Astronomer Bob Berman is back in Studio A to answer your astronomy questions. Bob is one of the best-known, most widely read astronomers in the world. He is the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. His new book is Earth-Shattering, Galactic Collisions, Supernovas, Nuclear Meltdowns, and Other Mayhem That Threatens Life in the Universe. And if you have a question about life in the universe or nuclear meltdowns, give us a call, 800-348-2551, 1-800-348-2551. You can also email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, that number, 800-348-2551. Astronomer Bob Berman and your calls coming up on Vox Pop right after the news. Hello again. Welcome back to Vox Pop, WAMC's live afternoon call-in talk show. I'm Ray Graff. Renowned astronomer Bob Berman is back to answer your questions today. Bob's new book is Earth-Shattering. Let's see if I can get the subtitle from memory here. Galactic Collisions, Supernovas, Nuclear Meltdowns, and Other Mayhem That Threatens Life in the Universe, or something like that. Bob is also the astronomy editor for the Old Farmer's Almanac and a contributing editor at Astronomy Magazine. Always great to have Bob on the program. Our number is 800-348-2551. You'd be wise to get in now. Tends to get pretty crowded after a while. 800-348-2551. Or you can email us at voxpop@wamc.org. But again, the number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Ray. Great to be here.
Oh, you're so famous now. You were on Weekend Edition. You're being interviewed left and right. The Atlantic is going to excerpt your new book. You're a very famous person.
Thank you. And yet when I go down the street, I'm just another schmuck walking down the street. Nobody recognizes me.
Thanks for saying that. I appreciate
that.
Can
I not say that word? I guess I shouldn't say that.
You hit the delay if you have to, Zach, the engineer, is ready to throttle you already, Bob, and we've just begun, you know? So the book is going well?
I don't know. You know, it takes 6 months before I get a report on sales, so...
Yeah.
But it was fun writing it, and it's great that it's out, and the publisher is a nice publisher. I like them.
What's new up in the heavens? Anything? Venus is gone.
Venus is gone. I miss it. You know, after now that we
miss
have...
It. It'll be back.
Yeah, but it won't be back until late this year. Next spring, it'll be prominent again. You know, just to see that evening twilight, now that we have so much daylight, and then there comes night, and there's twilight, and it's just blank. There's no beautiful, brilliant star in it. Don't you miss Venus?
Not really. No, it was dark last night.
That was nice.
Was the moon? Is the moon late, or did it come up after I was asleep?
It's late. We're near we're in a moonless time. A nice
beautiful,
moonless
dark,
time.
Clear skies last night.
I loved it. I was out looking at the North Star from the new observatory site to see how I'm going to. Because you mentioned that, do I have to realign this new observatory?
So you're having a new observatory.
Yes. On Monday, they're coming from Minneapolis to build this new dome observatory.
You know, most people I think I'll get a pool put in. No, Bob's having an observatory put in. That's nice.
Yes. Very exciting.
That's great. And so what telescope will we be using for that?
I'm going to move one of the telescopes that were in the old observatory, a Takahashi, a 5-inch Takahashi, which is the smaller of the scopes. But why am I talking about this technical stuff? Nobody's going to follow this, but you know, I love it. It's exciting, and the mount is just this big, almost military grade thing built in Japan, and I'm going to play with this for the next year. This will be fun.
You know, when we're kids, we all look up at the sky with awe. Now, you have been in this game for a long time. Do you still, when you look up at the sky, feel a sense of awe?
I do. Yeah, absolutely. Yes, I surely do. And you know what I like, too, is not knowing everything in the sky, because I know the northern sky. When I was a kid, I memorized every star name and their distances and spectra. It's easier than it sounds more impressive than it is, because there's only a couple hundred stars that have names, even the little ones.
Yeah.
So learning the names of every star in the sky is actually very doable, and I did it when I was a teenager, and it comes in handy because I'm out giving a talk at Mohawk Mountain House, I'm not supposed to mention.
Why not? You can mention that, sure.
And then somebody will say, "Oh, what's that?" And you know, I've waited 40 years to say, "Well, that's Arcturus. It's 36 light years away," or et cetera.
Well, you know, we have apps for that now. You just hold it up.
I know, but it's still not the, you know, this is a venerable tradition that goes back thousands of years, learning the sky. And I'm really sorry that the kids these days are using apps and not doing the hands-on stuff. And it's not just that people are not making telescopes or buying as many telescopes, but I've noticed that I think people are not even doing bird watching and canoeing and hands-on stuff. It's more like looking at screens.
Oh, I think people do.
I hope so.
I think people do. You know, I was out taking the air one night, and I'll use that in quotes, and my eye caught a constellation I have never really struck me. And I said, "Oh God, that looks odd." So I pulled out the app. It was Taurus.
Yeah, Taurus.
That's a good looking constellation.
It is. It shapes like the letter V.
Yeah.
And these days, if you look there, the planet Mars is visiting Taurus. Mm. So it looks like there's two bright orange stars. One is Mars and one is the real main star of Taurus, Aldebaran. And they're both side by side. And the moon is going to be there in about a week or two on, April 7th and April, we're past that. Later, another week or so, the moon is going to visit to form a triangle with these two orange stars. And then also in that constellation is the Pleiades, the seven sisters.
Yeah, it was up to the right,
yes,
I believe. Yes,
exactly.
Yeah.
So you point binoculars at it, just those lying around binoculars that you never use, and now suddenly it's transformed into this glorious, beautiful star cluster with blue stars.
Yeah.
It's the most powerful thing binoculars can do, is the transformation of the seven sisters from just six stars, which is what the average eye sees, to this wonderful star cluster. Second nearest to Earth and the brightest in the whole sky, and there it is. Still can be seen just after sunset if people want to know, what are you talking about?
Oh, the Pleiades.
Yeah, right after sunset, as soon as it gets dark, you look above where the sun set, about a third of the way up the sky, and look for that. The only star cluster, the clear star cluster.
I always use that cluster to see how my eyeglasses are doing. If I can pick out four or five, but with a naked eye, I feel like, all right, I can still see okay. Let's go for a call here. 800-348-2551 is the number. 1-800-348-2551. Bob Berman, our guest today. Richard in Hanacroy. Richard, you're on.
Yes, it may have happened previously on a show. Your guest may have been the one that inspired this, but what I'm trying to find out, and I did a little bit of research, but dark skies, so bright that you can see your shadow from the Milky Way.
Yeah, Bob's and talked about I'd that. Peru, right? Where do you go?
Fine, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. That's one of the criteria that we use to really be able to say, yes, these are truly dark skies. When the Milky Way is so brilliant that it casts shadows, and I lead a tour every year down to Chile, and always during the dark of the moon. And so I always have the group, typically 40 people, put their backs to the Milky Way and then wave their hands over their head so they can see their blurry shadow. It's not a sharp-edged shadow because the Milky Way is such an extended object, but it's a blurry shadow, but a clear shadow cast by the light of the Milky Way, so they can come back later and tell their friends, yeah, the Milky Way cast my shadow on the ground.
Yeah, and so that's a good spot to go.
Oh,
nice, clear
skies. And there's a few places, certainly in the Adirondacks and in the Catskills, that are far enough away from towns that it'll do the same thing during the months when the Milky Way is at its brightest, which is August, September, October.
It's amazing what light pollution, even when you think you're in a spot that's fairly dark and you're, you know, we're just outside the city of Albany and we get some dark skies. Wife and I went up for a wedding in September up to the Adirondacks in the middle of nowhere. And I got to tell you, the stars, they were like, you could almost pick them out of the sky.
I know. It's marvelous, isn't it?
Bob Berman is our guest today, and his new book is Earth Shattering. And there's a long subtitle. I'll let you figure that out on your own. 800-348-2551 is the number if you have an astronomy question for Bob. We'll be back. Vox Pop on WAMC, 800-348-2551 is our number. Bob Berman is our guest. Astronomy is the topic, 800-348-2551. Now we go to Joseph in the Pioneer Valley. Joseph, you're on. Hello, Joe. Zach, the engineer, is now holding his head in his hands. How are you there, Joseph? Oh, for Pete's sake. All right, what do you say? Hang up? Okay, I'm sorry, Joseph. Zach, the engineer, he can get a little cranky, and, you know, that's the way it goes. Hello, 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 who's this?
I'm here, are you here?
Are you here?
Can you hear me?
Yes, can you hear me?
I can hear you.
Hi, who are you?
Joseph.
Hello.
From the Pioneer Valley.
Hello, Joseph in the Pioneer Valley, you're on.
Well, great. I wanted to ask whether Bob, in referring to people casting a shadow, whether it was the shadow of the Milky Way or of Earthshine.
No, it was the Milky Way. We always go there when there's no moon out, so there's no chance of seeing Earthshine. And even if you could see Earthshine, the other part of the moon is brighter than the Earthshine
part. What's Earthshine?
Earthshine is when the dark part of the moon glows.
Oh, okay.
Which it does whenever it's a crescent. In fact, the thinner the crescent of the moon, the brighter the Earthshine is. You know why? You know why?
No, why?
This might be interesting.
More surface area?
No, because the moon and the Earth have complementary phases. So whatever the moon looks like, the Earth is the opposite, meaning that if the moon is a thin crescent, we're almost a full Earth in the moon at that time.
Wow, that's really interesting. That makes sense, too.
That's a fact that in all my years I never knew.
You see?
I never thought of, even.
So one consequence of that.
But
one consequence of that is that when the moon is a thin crescent, that means the Earth is brightest in the moon's sky, and that's why Earthshine is brightest.
We got it.
At that time.
Yeah. All right, so go ahead, Joseph.
Second quick comment is having to do with, Bob and somewhat, lamenting kids looking at apps instead of looking at stars. And this may sound far, not related, but I worked at a place that sold things like slide rules. And, when calculators took the place of slide rules just disappeared. And engineers who used slide rules, like, professors of engineering, things like that, the regret that they had was that when people switched over to using calculators, one of the things they lost was that commonsensical thing you get when you're looking at something that makes sense on a slide rule, but on a calculator, you have no clue whether it makes sense or not. So that's basically my comment.
I think that's a great comment.
I love slide rules back in the
high
school.
I do too. I unfortunately never managed to steal one from the place I worked.
Nice one.
Yeah, but they were gorgeous.
I kept mine in the attic for many years, and lovingly would fondle it once in a while. But it did not give you the digits, as many digits, of course, as calculators could with the same accuracy.
No, but they got us to the moon and back.
You're right, you are. Yeah. Hey, thanks for the call, Joseph. Our number here is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here. And let's see here. John in Oneonta. John, you're on.
Hi, I'm an amateur astronomer. We've had 4 telescopes, 2 home built.
Yeah.
Great.
With the one we built is a 10-inch with an F5 and a strobe ratio of, I think it's 0.93. How important is that strobe ratio?
Well, the ratio is very important because these days, as you probably know, most people have reflectors that are much faster, that are F4 or F5, and because of that, it lets them have a shorter tube, it lets them get a brighter image, but that secondary obstruction is so large relative to the aperture itself that you're going to have a rather blurry and not clear view of planets and the moon. So with the F ratio, a nice what you have, F9, that'll give you everything. It'll give you the deep space objects, and it'll give you the planets and the moon. So, but when you say home built, do you actually grind your own 10-inch mirror? Because that's a pretty big mirror to make yourself.
No. No. I spent $200 or so for a 10-inch one.
Okay, and then you built the rest of the telescope around it.
Yeah,
I built the rest of the telescope and the mount.
Oh, and the mount. I'm really impressed. Do you still have the instrument?
Yes, I do. I built the spider that holds the secondary. Everything. Built everything.
Oh, that's terrific.
Except for the primary mirror.
All right.
I wanted to also share Clear Dark Skies or ClearDarkSkies.com.
Yeah.
Are you familiar with it?
No, not that one. There's other apps that if I use
it gives cloud cover, seeing, transparency.
Nice.
And everything.
Oh, let me ask you, what was your favorite object that you looked at with that homemade telescope?
Andromeda, naturally, you know, and the Pleiades.
You like the Pleiades, yep.
Yeah. Okay, well, John, thanks for the call. Now, the Pleiades are actually not, they look close together, but they're not close together, right?
Yeah, they're 410 light years away, so they're fairly close, but they're spread out enough that the moon can fit inside the Pleiades easily. So in other words, this is a wide object, and that's why telescopes usually don't show the Pleiades well, because the Pleiades spill out beyond the field of view.
But I mean, the stars themselves are far apart, right?
Yeah, they're far apart, certainly a quarter of a light year.
And it's just random luck that they're all sort of visible as a group.
Well, not random. They were all born together. They were all the same age. They're all spectral class B, and they came from the same cloud of hydrogen gas. For a long time, we thought the wispy nebulosity that surrounds the Pleiades, you see that in photographs, was their embryonic fluid, was the nursery from which they sprang. But now we feel that the Pleiades are just happen to be passing through this cloud of dusty gas, and that the gas that they were born from is no longer visible.
But they were all born together.
They were all born together.
So really sisters.
Oh, yeah. They're born 120, 150 million years ago, pretty young. Our sun is 4.5 billion years old, so something that's only a little more than 100 million years old. These are young baby stars, and just lovely. They have so much lore and legend surrounding them. In mythology, they're the daughters of Atlas.
Yeah.
In fact, the two stars on the left, Atlas and Pleione, were the mother and the father of the rest of the Pleiades, who have lovely names like Maia, Teigeta, Merope, Asterope, Celino. Lovely. And then, for many centuries, they were associated with evil.
Yes.
Evil. And the date when the Pleiades reached their highest point at midnight, that was the Black Sabbath of the Middle Ages, and that which eventually became our Halloween.
Well, I'll be darned.
And cultures from the Maya to the Mesoamericans to the ancient Greeks, many of them saw the Pleiades as like a monument to a terrible event.
Huh.
And some have even speculated that that they're associated with the Atlantis myth, which in turn probably was due to the eruption of the Saturn volcano that destroyed the advanced civilization on Crete about 1450 BC. And so it seemed to happen at a time of year when the Pleiades were high.
Ha.
And so this was the Pleiades might have been a commemoration of all the loss of life of that civilization that gave rise to the Atlantis thing.
The things you know. So the Black Sabbath comes from that.
Yeah, Black Sabbath.
I wish we had some black. Do we have any Black Sabbath war pigs or something to crank up here for bumper music? No. No. All right. Let's. You know what? On second thought, let's not do that. Let's go back to the phones. Mark in Salem. Mark, you're on.
Oh, my God, it's hard to follow your guys' conversation.
Tell me about it.
I'm pleased to see that somebody else builds their own telescopes. I've called before. I have my 17.5-inch reflector finished, and the building's going up this spring, I hope. I have another building that actually is an observatory, another piece of property, and I'm thinking about making a solar observatory out of it. And I was wondering what Bob might suggest as what I should look for, like in the equipment in terms of tunable or double? I don't quite understand the technology, I guess.
Yeah, those stacked systems versus the tunable systems, you can't go wrong with. You know, I'm not allowed to give commercial things here, but.
No, I understand.
But the Lunt. The Lunt, L-U-N-T, solar equipment is always top quality, and these days everyone's talking about that. Let me ask you, your 17.5-inch telescope, so that's going to have its own observatory, you're saying?
Yeah, it's a separate building, and I have another piece of property where I had built, but unfortunately the house that was on it burned.
Wow.
So I left with a building and a barn, and I thought, well, I'll just convert that into something for use in the daytime. Since it's covered, and I'll be able to have, if it's cloudy at night, use that in the day.
Yeah.
And people can come in and enjoy it. That's the what I intend.
Is it in a dark site?
Couldn't get much darker. We're north of Casa Una Lake. There's nothing around us for 30 miles.
Oh, nice.
Good for you. Great, great, great. I'm so glad to hear that. That's great.
All right.
So a tunable is.
Yep, they're both good, and of course we always have to balance price against what you're going to get for the price. But contact
how is it tuned?
The tune actually it changes the wavelength. You know, typically these have a half angstrom to between a half angstrom and a one angstrom bandpass filter. And it changes with the pressure. It actually has a pressure tunable. By changing the air pressure in the system, it changes what it does. You might contact OPT telescopes and camera and talk to them about the Lunt instruments and see what they've got.
All right, Mark, thanks for the call. Bob Berman, our guest. Astronomy is the topic. 800-348-2551, the number. Chuck in Clifton Park. Chuck.
Yeah, hi.
Hi.
Can you hear me?
Sure.
Hello?
Hello. Hi. How are you?
Can you hear me?
Sure. How about you?
Can you hear me?
Yo, yeah. Yeah, we can. Can you hear us?
Yes.
Tremendous.
All right. You know, I feel a little funny calling you because this isn't a really smart person's question, but
okay.
You're talking about the dark sky, and it got me to my nagging thought that I've always had about it's inconceivable that isn't life on other planets.
Okay.
And I was just curious what Bob's thinking on that.
Oh, okay. Well, Bob, what do you think?
Well, there's a lot of different ways to tackle it. Everything from that the entire universe is a form of life to consciousness and nature, and that means the universe is correlative. It goes together since physics is increasingly telling us for the last century that unless it's observed, it's not real.
Right.
So in a way, and this sounds very Woodstocky and strange to say, but it seems that consciousness is bound up in everything. And if that's the case, then at least in some sense, the whole universe, there may not be anything that's not,
okay,
in a sense, a form of life. But I know what you're talking about. You're talking about balls of planets or
moons
on the surface
on
of which
sure
there are creatures. And unfortunately,
yeah,
we have only one example of it. And so how much, you know, extrapolation can we do when we only have one example? And that's why it's so important to get to Jupiter's moons and places like that that have water, places like Europa that have oceans, and in this case, warm saltwater oceans, because if life did start on Earth in the oceans, which it did, then other places which also have warm saltwater oceans for billions of years and that have had amino acids injected into them, just like Jupiter's moons has, there's no reason there should not be life there. And if there isn't, then we can be pessimistic and say, well, maybe it's a very rare thing to have life. But so that's our first thing. To answer your question, we've got to go to places like Saturn's Enceladus and Jupiter's Europa and sample the warm saltwater oceans there and see what, if anything, is swimming or floating there.
That's why I find the Drake equation to be something of snake oil.
It is snake oil. I'm so glad to hear you say that. You know, I get back home, and the people in my family say, He's so smart. Ray just comes up with these things. Who would say that the Drake equation is snake oil except for you?
Right.
And you're absolutely right. The Drake equation, for people who don't know what it means, is a way of trying to guess the preponderance or the possibility of life in our galaxy. So it's the equation is really you just multiply. First, you start out with how many planets are likely to be in the universe. You get that number. Now, he didn't know. Frank Drake didn't know it when he was doing this, but now it looks like there's as many planets at least as there are stars.
Right.
And in our own galaxy, that means at least 400 billion.
Right.
So you start with that, and then you multiply that by a fraction, which is what percentage could be habitable. Is not too hot because it's too close to its star, or not too cold where you couldn't have liquid water. So you multiply it by that. Then you multiply it by some things that he did, and this is why I think you're calling it snake oil. Guesses like, well, if life starts, how long does life remain before it destroys itself or just dies out? In other words, what's the average lifespan of a life form? 50,000 years, a million years, 5 million years. And so Drake had to guess on these. So you put a guess in with this and you continue on with multiplying and then you wind up with a number. His number was that there's at least another planet in our own Milky Way galaxy that has life. And there could be as many as tens of thousands, depending upon what you figure to put into those other numbers.
And, you know, a more basic reason why I think it's possibly just jive is that, and you mentioned this, until we go to the moon of Jupiter or wherever and we find that one living microbe, once we find one of those somewhere else, then you can kick a Drake equation in. Until then, for all we know, we're the only ones.
Exactly, exactly. In fact, it was not Drake, but one of the two, I don't know if it was Crick, one of the two discoverers of DNA. Not Hubble, but I'll think of his name in a moment, the steady state, Hoyle.
Yeah.
Who said early in the 50s, once we realized what it takes to form life, that you need such complexity and arrangements of the molecules to form life. We don't even know how to do it. But when he realized how complex it is, and the idea is, you know, science generally says it's random. Life formed on Earth randomly, just random processes.
Right.
And he said it would be the same as saying that a tornado goes through a junkyard and just assembles a working 747 just from the pieces, swirling them in the air. He said, and he wasn't kidding. He said, that's as likely as that random processes are just going to swirl together stuff and come up with life. He said it's virtually a dumb thing to say, this whole idea that life started randomly, because it seems impossible that it could start randomly. But then you'd say, well, if not, then how? And we want to avoid God and religion.
Why
and
do we want to
other.
Avoid that?
Because
why is that science against that? Let's get into hang on. Let's take a call before you tell me why science must be against the presence of God. Our number is 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is our guest. Paul in Hinsdale is next. Paul.
Hey, Ray. Hi, Bob.
Hey.
So this is a little off your current topic, but my question is, I'll keep it short. We've estimated the universe to be about 13.7 billion years old. And I believe that's based on the most distant visible light that comes back to us. So any objects beyond that threshold would be expanding faster than the speed of light.
Quite right.
So not knowing what's beyond, could you concede that the universe is potentially greater and older than we perceive, or even infinite?
Yes, yes. Well, that's the big question. We know that the visible universe, you're making a great point. What we can observe is limited from here to 13.7 billion light years away, because that's where light can reach us from. But at that point, things don't stop. Objects are just receding from us faster and faster and faster. At that point, they recede at the speed of light. But the number of objects we observe up to that point actually increases. There's more and more of them when you get to this point, simply because the formula for the volume of a sphere is 4/3 pi r³. So it increase the amount of stuff increases vastly as you look farther and farther. So the idea is that at that point, we can't see anything beyond that point, but all the evidence, and there's powerful new evidence 4 years ago from the University of California that surveyed 900,000 galaxies, and it showed that the topology of space is so flat leading to that point that objects must continue on beyond that point. So but how much farther does that go? Mm. So the caller just said, could that be infinite? It could be infinite. We just simply don't know. So the vast majority of the universe is beyond the visible universe. And what's there and how much stuff is there, nobody can say.
So if the universe is without end, does that mean it's also without beginning?
Oh, you mean time-wise?
Yeah.
Yes, because you don't see any way to get to infinity from a finite starting point, and you don't see any way to get to eternity from a finite time in the past.
All right, my head's going to explode. Let's take a break. 800-348-2551. Bob Berman is here. Every now and again, he puts me to the point where my head will explode, and we're there. So let's just take a quick break. Boy, am I glad that Zach the Engineer didn't throw on the old Black Sabbath bumper music that I had mistakenly suggested earlier. There's not time. No, there's not, Zach. I'm sorry. Bob Berman is here. The number is 800-348-2551. Quickly, Bob, we just sort of dangled it out there, the presence of God in the scientific community.
Well, when you get to the real imponderables, how did life begin? And is the universe infinite or not? How did the universe begin? Of course, religions have been tackling this since forever, and generally a good percentage of the population, maybe most, would say, well, God did it. So why doesn't science say that? Because you've got to leave God out of this for a couple of reasons. One, it was always the reason when you didn't know the answer, like when we used to say, why does the wind blow? Now, before we knew about high pressure and low pressure areas and changes of temperature, which is what really causes the wind, we'd say, well, the only explanation, God creates the wind. There's no other explanation. Once you knew about pressure systems, you stopped saying that God did that, even if you believed in God, just because we had a mechanism in place. So to talk about astronomy and then bring God into it is sort of like saying, well, we have no other observational, experimental reason to give you. We have nothing to say. We're out of things to say, and so therefore we're saying God did it. It's almost like a giving up.
Hmm.
So science doesn't want to do that. And secondly, there's a percentage of scientists who are real kind of dyed-in-the-wool atheists who really believe, I think this is an unfair criticism, but they believe that to believe in God is to be anti-science. They equate it with believing that the earth is only a few thousand years old, to believe in Bible stuff that contradicts science. And so they lump it all in the same thing, so that if you believe in God, you're one of those that are denying science. And we don't want to do that. Science is too important in our culture, in our technology, in our lives. We don't want to do that.
Okay.
So we stay away from it. So those are two of the
reasons. All right, Bob, this came in via email from another Bob, a different Bob. Bob writes, I recently heard something about a new space vehicle that was going to measure the temperature of the corona, noting how much hotter it is than the surface of the sun. I've also heard mention of the temperatures at the sun center and at various levels up to the surface. How do we know these temperatures? And that's Bob.
In terms of corona, we can actually measure it, and it's been a puzzle for many, many years because it's about 4 million degrees. And since the surface of the sun, the gaseous surface, the photosphere, is 11,000 degrees. This is Fahrenheit. If you want Celsius, then I'd say it's almost 6,000 degrees
Kelvin?
Celsius. Same. Kelvin and Celsius
okay.
is actually the same. But Fahrenheit, 11,000 degrees. How do you go from a surface that's 11,000? How can you possibly get to 3 million degrees by going farther from the sun?
Yeah.
It makes no sense. So this is a big, big puzzle. And the answer seems to be, although we're not 100% sure, magnetic lines that connect and reconnect. And when they snap and reconnect, it creates heat.
Uh-huh.
And yeah, it'd be good to measure these things. The center of the sun, of course, cannot be probed directly, but there you simply do it by how much energy is being released from the sun, which is the same.
All right,
I love this figure, as 96 billion hydrogen bombs per second.
And yet it's not likely to go out this week or next week.
No, we're good.
That's good. This one came in from Jay. Can you describe how a star forms and at what point it stops gathering material and officially becomes a star? What determines a star's size? Is there a limit of forming that is too big or too small? And that is from Jay.
Well, great questions, but there's whole textbooks on this subject. So the Reader's Digest short answer is simply that you start off with hydrogen gas, the most common substance in the universe, and if there's enough of it in a cloud, and there's a little glob of it, it might have its own gravity a little bit that'll start pulling itself smaller. And once it has gravity, the nature of gravity is that the smaller you get, the more forceful it becomes. And so it's a self-collapse of hydrogen. And what really determines it is how much is collapsing.
How much hydrogen there is.
Exactly, because the mass of a star, the weight of the star, determines everything else about it. Our sun is a little bit heavier, more massive than the average star, just a little bit. And so most of the stars in the universe are lighter in weight. And if you're lighter in weight, you don't have a lot of power in the core. You're not going to be giving off a lot of heat, which means you're going to be cooler, not in the hip sense, in the temperature sense. And that means you're going to be red. Red is a cooler color than blue hot, red hot. So most of the universe's stars are what we call spectra class M. They're red stars because they're lighter weight. The universe is filled with lightweight stars. 43 out of the 50 nearest stars are of this type, dwarf M class stars. But if you get a star that's more massive, now it could be yellow or white or even blue, like the dog star Sirius, 8 light years away. There you have a star 2.4 times heavier than ours. And now you got a blue-white star, but it goes through its fuel faster, so it dies in its youth. It never lives long. So what I'm saying is all these other things, how long the star will live and how bright it is and what color it is and what temperature it is, they all go together determined by the weight or the mass of the star.
And so the gas giants we see are, if they had been much more massive, could have ignited.
Yes, and a supernova has to be a very massive star unless it's formed by a white dwarf that's accreting material from a companion. Other than that, the only stars that blow up on their own are the very massive, heavy stars, more than 8 or 10 times more massive than our sun.
Bob Berman is our guest. Let's go to Nancy in Queensbury. Nancy, you're on.
Well, hello. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Oh, good. This very esoteric conversation is going to be dragged into the back down to earth, I think.
Good.
My question is, I look at the night sky a lot, and I think it's only happened twice. I know it's happened once. I've looked up in the sky, and I have seen one single bright pinpoint flash. And I know that flashes occur. I mean, there's the pulsars that flash continually and all that, but this was just like one flash.
I can help you.
I mean, there may be a billion things.
It's cosmic ray hitting your retina.
No, I'll give you the answer to that. What you saw was an iridium satellite.
Oh.
There's a whole bunch of iridium, which was a communication satellite back in the old days when they thought we needed to carry these big brick-sized cell phones. And no matter where you are in the world, you can get telephone service from a satellite, an iridium satellite. They're still in orbit. And they have these giant solar panels that are so big that they reflect the sun's light brilliantly, but onto just a little spot on the Earth.
Oh,
so
very
interesting. As they orbit, they produce a band on Earth as they orbit around Earth that gets a brief spot of light. And they're so brilliant, they're brighter than any star in the sky, but they only last for a few seconds, and then they completely disappear. But if you go online, you can do a search for finding out when, from your location, whatever city, or even if you're in the country, whatever spot, when the next bright flash will be in the sky
that
from
is
iridium
so interesting.
Satellite, and what direction to look, and how high up, and exactly to the second, what time you'll see the next one.
that's cool.
Yeah.
Because, you know, being so random, and like I say, I think I may have seen it twice, but that's very cool.
Yeah. Look for that. Go ahead.
Oh, I was just going to say, binoculars. I have a pair of binoculars, and I get so frustrated. I'm going to have to figure out, put a chair in front of me and rest my elbows, because with binoculars, I'm so unsteady, you know?
Yeah.
So I'm going to have to figure out some way to do that.
Well, if you're rich enough, the answer to that are the new, meaning the last 20 years, binoculars have been made with these image stabilized properties that you press a button, and no matter how much your hand is shaking, the image is rock steady.
So it's like a Steadicam. Like in TV, they have Steadicams.
They're not cheap. They're $500 and more, but boy, are they great. Canon makes them. Look for the image-stabilized binoculars. I wouldn't get the absolutely lowest, the cheapest of them, but anyone other than the very cheapest model is quite good and quite amazing. The optics are good, and when you hold that button, the image, whether you're looking at birds or whether you're looking at the sky, will be rock steady.
Oh, how about that? Well, Nancy, thank you for the call. Bob Berman is our guest. 800-348-2551 is the number. Let's go to Justin in Waterville. Justin.
Hi. I had a question about the creation of the universe. I had a friend that worked at CERN over in Europe, and they were working on a theory about like our universe existing within a bubble. And outside of that was just like helium and hydrogen, anytime it could pop, leaving it just hydrogen and helium all over again, which doesn't leave much room for me, which is anxiety inducing. I didn't know if you had any ideas about that, or any progression in the theory of the creation of the universe. And then just quickly after that, if you could, what would exist outside the universe, and how could the universe just exist?
Okay, well, your second question, what would exist outside of the universe? By definition, universe means everything there is. So if you define it like that, there can't be anything outside, unless you believe in multiverses, and then you're opening up a whole other bag of worms, and there's no evidence to indicate that that's so. Birth of the universe, you know, there's so many ideas, but this is one of those areas where you just have to honestly say, we don't know. Mm-hmm. Because you could say, well, are there brains, meaning membranes that were already there that hit each other? Why could the universe start as the size of a raisin 13.8 billion years ago and suddenly start expanding from there? How did that raisin get there? Was it a collapse of a previous universe? And if there's anything that you have to honestly say, I don't know. Hmm. This is it. I don't know. So all ideas that are come up with, they're ideas, they're just words at this point.
Unless, you're not really helping Justin's anxiety.
I know, and I can't.
All right. Well, good luck, Justin. Thank you for the call. And Sherritt in Shokan is on. Hello.
Hello. Just wondering if ever there has been or ever we expect to have an alignment of all of the planets.
Well, to get all of them
line from the sun.
Yeah, to get all of them together won't happen in our lifetime, certainly. In 1982,
had
enough planets in one quadrant of the universe. In other words, like pretend you're cutting a pie of one quarter of the solar system, and all the planets were in that one quadrant of the solar system. That's what gave rise to that Jupiter effect.
It would book. End it all.
Plagnon and Griffin, who wrote that, who said it was going to cause the sun to erupt and that would make earthquakes. California was going to drop it into the sea,
sure.
Which of course didn't happen. But you don't get that. What you get are a few at a time, like currently Jupiter and Saturn. Jupiter's approaching Saturn. Jupiter's in Scorpio. Saturn is in Sagittarius. The next year or two, you're going to have those two, the biggest two planets, all lined up in space. And then Mars will come by and then add a third planet to that. And so that's what you really get realistically every few years. And a few years after that, Saturn is going to be lined up with Uranus, which is further east. And so that's what happens. A few at a time come and go. But all of them, not this century.
All right. Over to Ned in Del Mar. Hello, Ned.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Sure. You're on.
Okay. So I was on a Caribbean island about 2 weeks ago at the full moon, standing on a spot where I could see both moonrise and sunset. So So they happen at exactly the same time. Local people said they take it for granted. Is this a function of the time of year, the location? Could it happen here?
It does happen here because when you think about it, how is the moon full? It can only be full if the sun is, from our perspective, shining straight down on it. So you got to have this configuration for a full moon. You got to have the Earth. You have to have the Earth in between the sun and the moon so that the sunlight, from our perspective, is making the moon full without any shadowing or phases to it. So when can you see that line up? Just as you said, at sunset. Thanks to the refraction, bending objects up by half a degree when they're on the horizon, the fact is, at the moment that it's full, the sun will rise. It's the other way around. The sun will set at the moment that the moon rises, making them both hard to see because they're right on the horizon. But refraction bends both of them up half a degree, letting you see what you saw from that Caribbean island, where both of them, the full moon, is coming up just as the sun is setting. And that happens every single month.
Great. Thank you.
Sure.
Thanks a lot, Ned. And let's see here. Let's go to Rebecca in Glenmont. Rebecca, you are on.
Hello.
Hi, Rebecca. How are you doing? Okay. Goodbye, Rebecca. Kelso in Hancock is on. Hello. Oh, for Pete's sake.
Hello.
Hello there. You know, Bob, sometimes it doesn't pay to get up and go to work in the morning. Zach, the engineer, says, I told you we should have played Sabbath. I still don't know. I'm not sure. Mary Beth in Albany. You have about 1 minute, Mary Beth.
Hello. Okay, real quick. That whole question that he brought up about God and science.
Yeah.
And is there... I loved the question, and I loved his answer. I was taught by nuns all my life in education, and never did a question come up about there being anything that wasn't in sync, there was no question that you were given a brain to think and to learn, and that in itself is miraculous.
Agreed. Agreed. Well, thank you. That's a good way to end the show. Bob Berman, good luck with the new observatory that's going in.
Thank you.
I hope that the weather's good for the gentlemen who are going to put it together.
I hope you'll come down and visit us with your kids this summer when it's all put together.
It may soon fall apart if they all come down at once. The book is called Earth Shattering, and can you recite the subtitle?
Even I don't remember. It's something like supernovas, cosmic explosions, galaxy collisions, nuclear meltdowns, and other mayhem that threatens life in the universe, something like that.
All right, number one answer. Good job, Bob Berman. Support comes from the Tang Teaching Museum at Art Gallery at Skidmore College, providing exhibits, public events, and educational programs for audiences in the Capital District and beyond. Skidmore.edu/Tang. Identity Eyewear, Albany, New York, specializing in distinctive eyewear, European styling and prescription and non-prescription sunglasses, eye exams by appointment, EYEDENTITY, Eyewear, Albany.com. And the Palace Theater, presenting the Three Stooges Film Festival Monday, April 22nd. It's an evening of antics and slapstick on the Palace Theater's big screen. Tickets at PalaceAlbany.com. Thanks again to Bob Berman for being here today. Thank you for listening. Great calls, great questions, great emails, as always. Thanks to Zach Malloy for not playing the Black Sabbath on the program today. Your calls are answered by Amber Sickles. Our producer is Jim Lavoulis. I'm Ray Graff. Tomorrow on Food Friday, we'll explore Jewish cuisine with the folks from this weekend's Jewish Food Festival in Schenectady, New York. That is tomorrow at 2 p.m. Right now, stunning news, breaking news. Stand by for the Capital Connection.